at home tonight against the Arizona Coyotes. Of course, Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday, Super Bowl 57. Eagles, Chiefs, kickoff is set for 5:30. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, 10th of February. Partly sunny for the morning, sunny for the afternoon, a high of 33. Right now, wind west at 10, some gusts up to 20 miles per hour, 32 degrees Kenosha, 30 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This past weekend, my wife Kathy and I were privileged to be in the audience. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm very excited. Please stand by. Please stand by. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Sorry for that little technical kerfluffle here at the outset. We're going to have a couple of different interviews related to this weekend's Super Bowl. And we begin with this interview from the archives about a book that celebrated the 50th Super Bowl, a wonderful book called Super Bowl Gold. Here's that interview. Well, if there is a football fan for whom you need to purchase a gift this holiday season, I heartily recommend a magnificent new book that is just out from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It looks back over the near half century of Super Bowls that have been played over the decades, and it helps chart the history of the game. And one of the things that we come away from as we see this book is how drastically the game has changed. That is, the Super Bowl itself, how drastically it has changed from that first Super Bowl waged back in 1967 when the Packers defeated the Chiefs in resounding fashion. There is very little about that game that could perhaps possibly have foretold just the incredible extravaganza which it would eventually become. Austin Murphy has done very, very good work in the beautifully written introduction which adorns this book, and he's here to tell us more about it. Once again, it's titled Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game, and it comes to us from Sports Illustrated, where he is a senior writer. Austin Murphy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. That was well done, and we appreciate the kind words. I'm right with you. It's astonishing to look back. Time has really flown. One of my favorite pictures, for purposes of comparing, you know, where we are and where we've been, was on the right-hand page. This is early on. There is a snapshot of, I think it was just a media day, which has turned into this frenzy with, you know, several thousand correspondents, and in some ways, it's sort of it's an apt metaphor. Or a reflection of what the game has become. It is excess embodied. And on the page next to it, there's Joe Namath in, I guess, what would be the 60s equivalent of board shorts. And he's, he's talking to a few journalists. I think it's on the beach outside the Fountain Blue Hotel, and it was right around the time he was guaranteeing victory, the Jets' victory over the Colts, which in fact he pulled off. He had just a kind of an ordinary game, but the Jets did beat the Colts, and it lent the game a lot of legitimacy. But they were certainly simpler times.
Absolutely. There is one lone television man with a microphone in Mr. Namath's face and a rather antiquated-looking TV camera we see in the foreground of the picture and a scattering of a few people in the background. And you're right. The opposite page of that spread shows a modern-day media day for the Super Bowl, and it is a mass of humanity. And right there in a nutshell is one very clear sense of how this game has become what somebody, I think it was you, said is now an international cultural extravaganza. As you look over this history, how much of your feelings about that are regret? That is, do you spend a lot of time regretting that what was in the beginning a fairly simple game between two great football teams has become this other thing? I mean, do you regret that at all? Not that you're responsible for it, but...
No, I think there was a time, perhaps when I was younger, when there would be resentment at, for instance, being sent into media day with instructions to, you know, find a fresh angle or try to get somebody by themselves, and it's just impossible. And I think now I'm just more, you walk into it and let the experience wash over you and kind of appreciate and not feel one way or the other about it. It's just, it is what it is, and it's where we are. It's interesting. I was the college football writer at Sports Illustrated for a decade or more in the aughts. I've had a couple of turns doing college football and wrote a book called Saturday Rules, really making the case for why the college game is more fun than, you know, the corporate colossus NFL, the no fun league. It's huge, anodyne, impersonal, and yet our focus groups repeatedly have told us that people cannot get enough of the NFL, and so here I am, and I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just I'm finding the stories in each locker room and making human connections, and grateful to have a job in print media in the year 2015.
Right. In your introduction called The Fantastic Voyage, which I think is beautifully written and really, really fascinating, you quote somebody as calling the Super Bowl America's last great campfire. I think it was a marketing officer from the NFL. You must think that's an interesting quote if you include it in your introduction. What do you think Mr. Waller is getting to when he characterizes the Super Bowl in this way, as America's last great campfire?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for the kind words. I remember making the point right around that place in the essay. I used that quote just to make the point that this game in particular, this event, has long since sort of transcended sport, achieved escape velocity. It is now, it's a global event. So we marvel at it for that reason alone, and how far it's come from that, you know, that first Super Bowl, which was really just a glorified exhibition game between, you know, the two champions of different leagues. What happens in every Super Bowl, the sort of things that we remember and talk about become a national currency. You know, the Monday, and for years and decades afterward, they're commemorated in books like this one and on NFL films. We're not just talking about what happened during the game, and hopefully we got a good game. Half the time you get a pretty good game, and 25% of the time I think you get a dog game or a rout, and the other times, like last year, you get a really good game, and that actually lives up to the hype. But it doesn't have to live up to the hype, because it is also a discussion about the Super Bowl halftime show. I have a another essay in the book talking about the evolution of the halftime show, which was a lot of fun. You know, the film festival, that is the discussion over, you know, who had the best commercial, you know, and who did what kind of a job on the national anthem. So there's a lot going on aside from, you know, what happened on third and long.
I am intrigued by some of the photographs that capture that very first Super Bowl, which I think you remind us was not even called a Super Bowl at the time. That name got attached a little bit later. But among the most striking things is to see just the smattering of fans that are in the stands. I mean, it appears like there weren't all that many people in attendance to see the Packers beat the Chiefs. And of course, that's in very stark contrast to what we see now, where it's probably one of the hardest tickets in all the world to get.
It is. And I know that I think the opening double truck photograph is from the first Super Bowl, and it, the captains are meeting midfield, and it's deliberately, there's this ocean of turf around them. There's only one zebra out there. You know, now there would be television cameras, and it would be a production unto itself, and it's quite deliberate. You know, just to show you, it reflects how small bore it was compared to where we are now. The point is well taken.
Right. I appreciate another point made in your introduction, in which you try to explain why there is this ferocious intensity when it comes to our fascination to the Super Bowl, our interest in it. Even people who otherwise are not particularly interested in professional football, but who find themselves drawn to this game. Not every single person, but of course a whole lot of people just cannot stay away. One of the points you make in your introduction is by contrasting the way the NFL figures out its ultimate championship with, for instance, Major League Baseball or the National Basketball Association. It's a relatively obvious point, and yet one that I don't think is all that often made or as clearly as you make it. What is it about the Super Bowl that stands apart from these other professional sports leagues?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, and it did seem self-evident. Anyway, what you're getting at is that these other championships, you know, these are best of seven series, and the, you know, football, the beauty of football is that it is, you know, it's one game. It's a one-off. How are you going to do on this particular day? So we will decide a champion not over the next 2 weeks, but over the next 3.5 hours, like 4 hours with the added commercials and halftime. And so it's the drama is distilled. But on the, you know, to be completely honest, you know, another thing that makes the game more picante for a lot of viewers is the fact that they have money on the game, or they bought a square, you know, the NFL doesn't, you know, prefers not to talk about it, but, you know, a lot of people have action on the Super Bowl that jacks up its appeal as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Austin Murphy, who's responsible for the introduction to a really magnificent new book from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. I think the way this book is put together is really quite ingenious. And I think it's terrific the way we sort of can attack this game from a lot of different angles. Can you just tell us who had a hand in the construction of the overall book and in, you know, making the decisions about the different elements that are represented here?
Yeah, you know, these are colleagues of mine, former SI editors. What's going on is that in print media, we're really, over the last decade or so, we've been really challenged to find different ways. It's a more challenging environment. So now we're doing more books. We're looking inward and seeing that we actually have some fantastic resources in the Sports Illustrated library. It's humbling for a writer to admit, but this book is carried by amazing photography. And I'm always, I'll see the photographers before the game. I like to take a lap during warm-ups, say an hour before, even if it's cold, and maybe overhear something. Rarely you'll get something in the notebook that you can use for your game story, but I'm always running into our photographers down there, and I've seen these people for decades, and it's often, we will exchange good-natured abuse because they believe that my job is easier because I can actually miss something and then catch up on it, debrief the players and coaches afterwards. But if they miss the game-winning touchdown, it's a big problem. They've always done magnificent work. It's called Sports Illustrated for a reason. To your point, it's they decided to break the book into quarters, so each sort of epoch of the league is, we'd get Super Bowls 1 through X11 in the first quarter, 8 through XX1V in the next quarter. And as you can see, another of the things that I don't care for about the NFL is these Roman numerals. please, can we do away with the Roman numerals? I think, they were sort of putting on airs early on. It's like they wanted to invest it with a dignity or something. But it's
grandiosity that in the early going it maybe didn't have, or people didn't see the grandiosity. And
yeah, now we're fine. Now you're fine, and you can get rid of it. It's like adding, spelling your shop with a OPPE. you're trying a little too hard. We don't need the Roman numerals.
Right.
Maybe I could just learn them and stop complaining about
it's,
them.
It's probably one of the only facets of modern American life where we still use Roman numerals. Also in the book, we have space devoted to each and every Super Bowl and an excerpt from the Sports Illustrated article written at the time, another little interesting column called Just the Facts, which includes important statistics from the game, and always a photograph of that particular Super Bowl ring, what the Sports Illustrated cover looked like. And another thing I really appreciate, and I suspect you do too, is with each and every chapter, there is something called The Way It Was, in which we hear from two different players and I suppose occasionally a coach, who were directly involved in the game. One from the winning team, one from the losing team. And I so appreciate this facet because somehow it brings the game alive on a whole different level by allowing us to hear from two of the gladiators who were directly involved.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, and that was a lot of work for people to go, to work the phones and find somebody from each game and debrief them and get an extra vignette or snapshot. I was just, from last year's game, we have the hero, the cornerback, the Patriots cornerback, Malcolm Butler, talking about how earlier in the week running against the scout team offense down on the goal line, they had run the same look slant pattern that the Seahawks called with, infamously now, notoriously. And Malcolm Butler was beat on the play. And he talks about how Coach Belichick walked up to him and said, you got to get that. And so when it was real, I watched Malcolm Butler, and I remember how aggressively he played that pass and how he just took the ball away. And it's just a nice few brush strokes that I hadn't gotten anywhere else. And so thanks for bringing that up.
Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Please.
I want to mention the fact that at the end of the book, there is a ranking of all of the Super Bowls from best to worst. And this is a really interesting list. And, of course, it's sure to generate all kinds of disagreement, consternation amongst people who have their own Super Bowl favorite that is not ranked as highly as they believe it should be. Do you know anything about how this ranking list came about? Were you part of it, a part of the calculations? And what do you think about the list as it appears here?
I was delighted to not be included in this process. it is a formula. It's not completely subjective. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories. So you get points for lead changes, fourth quarter drama, whether or not the team was an underdog, historical significance, and memorable player plays. And so the number one was the Giants 17-14 win over New England in Super Bowl XL11, which of course is you're going to let me know as soon as possible, but it was a helmet catch by David Tyree. And if you remember, Eli Manning dropped back and he was sacked. It looked like he was sacked 3 different times, and Eli incredibly showing escapability and finding David Tyree, who has since faded from the landscape. I guess my only quibble would be that even in a rout sometimes, and so the routes have all settled to the bottom, 40 through 49. But even in a lopsided game, for instance, the 85 Chicago Bears, so this would have been in the 86 Super Bowl, dismembered Tony Eason and the New England Patriots. But it was historic. This was the best defense of Buddy Ryan's defense for Coach Ditka. It was the best defense you've ever seen in the NFL, and so it was something, you were witnessing something you would never see again, and so it didn't deserve to be. Sometimes there's a sort of rubbernecking appeal to these routes, and there have been a number of really games that were over by halftime, and which is one of the reasons that Commissioner Ozell came around to it and realized they needed a very entertaining halftime show in case the Cowboys were slaughtering the Buffalo Bills or whatever. I like the rankings. Mostly, a book like this is basically fodder for argument, trivia, sort of the barstool conversations. You gotta have lists.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your point about, and I think maybe even in your introduction you mentioned the fact that sometimes a lopsided game like Seattle beating Denver 43-8 can be really intriguing. In this case, to see the Seattle defense humbling the great Peyton Manning. There was something really, really fascinating about that, even if the game was never close or in any doubt. it isn't always just about how close a game is fought. Sometimes there is something really fascinating in a clinical destruction of an opponent by someone who's vastly superior. Certainly in the game of tennis, sometimes a slaughter can be a really interesting thing sometimes.
There's something Shakespearean about it, and there's such a build-up. This is the only game of the season for which there's a 2-week build-up, which is a week too many as far as I'm concerned. And so the hype machine goes into overdrive, and the pains to, the celebrations of, the genius of Peyton Manning has an extra week to be amplified. And then to see him brought low, there's something perversely satisfying about that. And it wasn't just Manning, although he looked certainly didn't look like himself. I think it was the first play from scrimmage. There was a bad snap. Anyway, it was this fascinating entropy that takes place and seems to take place more often in the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. And we want to remind people that if they look at the book, you can certainly, as a Packers fan, of course, we have lots of Green Bay Packers fans listening, you can explore each and every one of the Packers' appearances in the Super Bowl. I think five in all but one ending in victories. And for Chicago Bears fans, you can see the Bears. And I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan as well. And it's, of course, really fun to read about the incredible successes which the Steelers have had in this big game. Let's finish up with your second essay, which is called Don't Touch That Dial. You briefly mentioned it earlier, in which you chart the dramatic transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl. I mean, in some respects, this is a perfect mirror of how the stature of the game has changed over the years, but it's also very much an indication of the excess that is also a mark of this extravaganza. On a really personal level, what do you think of this transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl?
Well, it was fun to do a deep dive on it, just because when I was younger and more cynical, I would think, and this is around the time we were getting we were having Up With People foisted on us. This is the kind of chipper group of young performers whose talent level ranged, between high school variety show and Waiting for Guffman. It was just this incomprehensible, it was busy, there was no theme, they meant well, it was too much, and it made too little sense. But what ended up happening was that there was the Super Bowl. I think Dorothy Hamill was skating around during halftime. I'm not sure how they got ice on the field.
Oh, I remember that. It was a small little circular area, and not enough to do much of anything, mostly a couple little spins. But, yeah, that was a bad miscalculation.
Well, that was the winter that Fox had counter-programmed and said, hey, listen, we all know how lame the halftime show is, so come on over to Fox for halftime. And in living color, they had a special show, and it was screamingly funny. It was raunchy, but the Wayans brothers. And the NFL got clobbered, and that was a turning point for them. They said, okay, we need to kind of rise above the dinner theater caliber entertainment. And I think they went out and got Diana Ross, and they started to take it more seriously. And the halftime show thereafter has been built around one, mega performer, and so it's become the most watched concert of the year. And then there was, of course, the Janet Jackson reveal, the inadvertent or advertent reveal, depending on who you want to believe. After which, the NFL sort of went cautious conservative. They went with a series of aging male rockers, a period of time I refer to as ARP with people, and which is kind of inside humor. And they've sort of gotten the drill down. The Madonna halftime performance was the ratings actually bumped up during that halftime. And but they're all really chasing Michael Jackson. I found it bogged down at the end. There was sort of a We Are the World treacle. But in the beginning, Michael Jackson was on fire, and he put on a fantastic show out in Los Angeles.
It's a really intriguing. I find myself, as I watch the halftime show, often wondering how many football fans watching the game are enjoying this. And, you know, most of the time, I'm not. I know I'm not, but it's not my kind of music. But of course, they're aiming for a wide swath of young America, I suppose, in the choices that they make. I just sometimes wish that, in a sense, they were aiming for something that would have even broader appeal. That my father-in-law would enjoy watching. Or right. I mean, there's a whole lot of Americans watching this Super Bowl, and I somehow feel like this halftime extravaganza is not designed with all of us in mind, in a sense. And maybe it can't be. Maybe that's impossible.
I remember watching the Black Eyed Peas a few years ago and just thinking of my octogenarian father in Rhode Island and wondering and just thinking what he must have been thinking, which is like, when, at what point did I lose the thread here? You know, he's, just the outfits, let alone the music. But, you know, I talked to an NFL executive VP about this, and they are the multi-generational family that goes to Vegas and is trying to find a show. Do you go to a magic show? Do you go to a Cirque du Soleil? No, that's too racy. So you can't get it right. I think I put it something along the lines of they are trying to find entertainment that would stretch like one of Keith Richards' neck waddles across multiple demographics, and it's an impossible errand. So maybe they've stopped trying, but they were, because you're doomed to fail. And I think a lot of people aren't enjoying it, but don't forget people like me who, even if it's bad, enjoy making fun of it.
You know, there are
people at the Super Bowl party who are gathered around, you know, mocking it, and there's something to be said for that too.
Right. Tell our listeners who Lucille Walker is. She's somebody mentioned in your very interesting essay on halftime entertainment.
Yeah, well, Lucille Walker, God bless her, is the widow of Tommy Walker, also known as Tommy the Toe, who was a child actor. Actually, his dad was a musician. He was a young musician. He's playing, he's leading the band in an old movie called Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But he was a World War II veteran who came back, and he was a hero. He matriculated at USC and was both a kicker and played in the marching band. He was the guy with the baton who led it, actually. So for extra points and field goals, he would come down from the stands, take off his Shaco hat, you know, the big hat, and kick. And he actually got a tryout offer with the Redskins, but instead took a job with Walt Disney. He was a showman, and he was the guy who first went to Pete Rozelle and said, how about if we do something special for the Super Bowl halftime? Let's have an extravaganza. And Rozelle famously said, why would we want to spend that kind of money? It's when everyone gets up to go to the bathroom. And so he won. In the early Super Bowls, I have to say, Tommy Walker had a great sense of music. You know, he was the guy who brought in the fantastic marching bands from the all-black colleges in the Southwest Athletic Conference. I'm talking about Grambling and Texas Southern. And he just had a great sense of showmanship that they lost their way a little bit for a while, I think, and then now maybe. And so Lucille Walker, I went to visit her in Southern California, and she made the same lament, and maybe they're finding their way now.
she tells you about the Super Bowl number 4, in which Tommy's halftime show employed 20,000 balloons, 50 American flags, 3,000 pigeons, 37 muskets, and 3 cannons, all for an on-field reenactment of the Battle of New Orleans. And you quote her later in the essay as saying that what America has always been hungry for is pageantry. And I guess that's as much as anything what the modern-day Super Bowl is about.
I think Tommy's shows were the word I was searching for earlier was coherence. The Super Bowl, you know, Elvis, one year they had a big magic trick and you had to put on 3D glasses, and it was sponsored by Pepsi. Yeah, and it was Elvis Presto, a solid gold dancer who I think had been a little down on his luck but got this gig. And it was just, it was incoherent. She was longing for the days. It's always easy to look backwards. But she felt that Tommy had gotten his due, and it made her sad. And we spent a nice afternoon together just looking through some old scrapbooks.
Hmm. Well, that essay is a really lovely piece. I think it has also appeared in the pages of the magazine itself. I remember reading at least something like it in Sports Illustrated. It was fun to return to it and learn so much about this aspect. And, of course, we want to remind people that the book, by and large, focuses mostly on the game of football and the way that it is played. And, of course, we hear not only about the luminaries who have made such a huge impact on the game, but also hear great stories about obscure players who have also figured one way or another. I think you tell us the story of a Green Bay Packer by the name of Max McGee, who scored the first touchdown in the first Super Bowl and had a little too much to drink the night before. Was that a story in your essay?
You know, I have at various times returned to the cautionary tale of Max McGee. I'm sure all Packers fans are familiar. For whatever reason, it's his account was one that that my people, the Murphys, I don't know, just sort of related to. But it's always be ready if you're a backup. But same, Don Beebe. I remember tracking down Don Beebe, the Buffalo Bill, who gave the Bills their only highlight in a rout. The Cowboys were just taking it to them, and Leon Lett had recovered a fumble, or perhaps he was rumbling 50-some yards with an interception return, but he held the ball out early, celebrating, and Don Beebe stripped him, and the Cowboys were not able to run up the score. And so I got Don Beebe and Leon Lett together to just talk about what the play had meant. And that was one of the reasons that Super Bowl wasn't sort of at the very bottom, because it had a memorable play.
Well, of course, we can look back over the rich history of the Super Bowl and all of the memorable plays that have been part of this great game in this really terrific book. Again, it's called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It comes to us from the good folks of Sports Illustrated with a really interesting introduction by Austin Murphy. Austin Murphy, thank you for being so generous with your time, and congrats to you and your colleagues at Sports Illustrated for putting together this terrific book, worthy of the assignment.
Thank you. I've done a lot of these hits, and nobody has really done their homework the way you have. And so I'm respecting you and thanking you for the incisive questions.
Appreciate it. Well, thank you so much. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Even if you're not a football fan, you have probably heard the news that Tom Brady, one of the greatest quarterbacks in the history of the NFL, has once again announced his retirement, and this time it appears to be a retirement that's going to stick. It's a great opportunity to replay for you a portion of a really interesting book called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback. The author of the book, Richard J. King, a college professor, set out in 2013 to try and meet his football hero, Tom Brady. And along the way, he met a wide array of fascinating people and kept posing the question of what would you do if you could meet Tom Brady? Here's an excerpt from our memorable conversation. One of the most interesting moments in this quest for you early on, relatively early on, came when you got to actually speak with Tom Brady's backup, who actually had to go in for him for essentially an entire season when he went down with a very serious injury from which he eventually recovered, of course, and eventually Matt Castle moved on to another team. But Matt Castle actually did stunningly well as Tom Brady's replacement. And you had the opportunity to actually speak with him in what had to sort of feel like a warm-up for the main event. Tell us a little bit about that encounter and how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, that, like you said, that started pretty early on in my adventure in the, you know, in the off season or maybe around the summer as moving up into training camp. And Matt Castle was the Vikings then. And I wrote to the Vikings and said, hey, is it possible to speak with Matt Castle? And, you know, a couple days later, they said, sure. And there I was in my office, and on my phone, it said Minnesota Vikings. And, you know, the press guy came on. He said, hey, Matt Castle's going to be on next. And then Matt Castle came on, and I was talking to Matt Castle. And he was a really nice guy, really warm, really great conversation, told all kinds of great stories. And I thought, gosh, maybe this actually isn't going to be that hard. Maybe a regular writer like me could talk to Tom Brady. And Matt Castle told a lot of great stories, like you said, about that, you know, when Brady got injured, that first game of, I think it was 2007 season, 2008 season, and, you know, what that was like all of a sudden when the doctor came up out after seeing Brady and realizing that Brady's season was over and basically said to Matt, you know, like in the middle of the first quarter, hey, the rest of the season is yours. And what wow. that would have been like for Matt Castle. And he said that when he went onto the field for the first drive, all of the New England fans stood up and applauded, which was kind of a, he said, was a really warm, exceptional response. And then he, you know, he was nervous for the first couple of plays, but then he threw a big bomb to Randy Moss, and then all of a sudden he loosened up. One great story Matt Castle told that I didn't include in the book, but I think was is a really intriguing one, is that when Matt Castle first got to training camp with the Patriots, he was kind of looking at real estate one ads because he didn't really think he would make the team. And Brady walked over to him and said, you have to put that away. You know, if you're here, you got to be completely committed, 100%. And even if that story is sort of, I don't know, maybe it's been changed over the years or maybe it's a little bit trite, but I think it says a lot about, you know, where someone needs to be. And, you know, it's a good lesson for all of us to sort of focus on
absolutely
what we're doing.
Absolutely. To have, I mean, and that's one of the reasons Tom Brady has achieved what he has, is that ferocious sense of focus, which he has. One of the really interesting aspects of this book, in some ways it's the heart and soul of it, aside from just the striving to meet Tom Brady, is the way in which you encounter a wide array of really interesting Patriots fans. And, of course, to many of them, you pose the question of what would you ask Tom Brady? And you end up amassing a really interesting array of questions from a variety of fans. And I find that so interesting, although I can't even quite sort out in my mind exactly why all of that is so very compelling. But there's something about that. It says a lot about football fans, and it says a lot about who Tom Brady is, and about when we feel this devotion to someone. A lot can be read into those interesting questions.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think so too. And I think a lot of those questions often just say a lot about who we are as people and what we're interested in. You know, so many people, I mean, we saw it this summer, just the amount of energy and attention and passion and vitriol over this Deflategate stuff when obviously they're, you know, far more important things going on in the world. And yet it's just football and sport. It just gives us this opportunity to kind of unload and reflect back on ourselves. It was amazing when I set up these tables at South Station in Boston or at my local mall asking people what they wanted to ask Brady, or when I toured, you know, the tailgating fields outside the big house, you know, that when people were asking me to ask something for Tom Brady, they were really asking, you know, what were their concerns? You know, what did they really care about? And, you know, at a certain point, you could start to predict what people were going to say. You know, you could look at that person and say, oh, they're going to ask about the money, you know, or they're going to ask about the fashion, or they're going to ask about Brady's politics, or they're going to ask actually about something more technical with football. Or for my optometrist, she wanted to know, does he wear contacts? That's all I really want to know.
One of the things that I liked about your extensive descriptions of Tom Brady is the fact that there are all these ways in which he is this incredibly impressive celebrity. I mean, and, you know, exceptionally handsome and married to a bombshell wife, I mean, who is so gorgeous. And together they enjoy this life of celebrity. And yet there are all these different ways in which Tom Brady somehow also manages to shed that and seems like a good person. And, you know, the kind of person that you just like, and the ways in which he is remarkably down to earth for all of the ways in which his life is lived kind of up in the stratosphere. Can you just say a word about how he has managed to accomplish that? In some ways, that's as impressive as anything he's done on the football field.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. And I like the author Charles Pierce talked about how the football player, you know, any, particularly the quarterback, is so much in the public eye, how much he's on television during a game. You know, they're even filming him, you know, when he's sitting on the sidelines. And that these guys aren't going into sports to be entertainers primarily. They're going to sports for the athletics. And yet there's so much that is put upon them as entertainers and speaking with the public. And, you know, even something like, if you're following the news yesterday, you know, Brady will say something about, you know, Donald Trump, and then all of a sudden this is, you know, Brady's official endorsement for who he thinks should be president. And you realize for someone like this that half of his life, starting in Michigan, he's been in the public eye and has had to watch every single thing that he says. And it's hard to imagine, you know, it's almost like a Lady Di kind of thing. You think like, gosh, the pressure that these folks are on to be in the media's eye for so long. And with Deflategate and, you know, people that would be incensed that Brady wouldn't know how to sort of speak to the press or that he would be telling a falsehood to the public, you know, someone like him, he's been telling falsehoods to the public since he got into the league. You know, every football player, when they get up on that stand, are basically told to, you know, just wax over, hey, how's your finger? Oh, it's fine, you know. So it's a very interesting thing. But after talking to so many people and so many sports writers, it's and seeing him in press conferences, he really does seem to be really good with the press, and he manages to not talk poorly about people and to at least present himself as a real team player. And, you know, none of us really know him. I don't know anything about him, but either he is really, really well coached at working with the press, or he genuinely is a really good guy and tries to be a team player and works hard not to speak ill of anybody.
Well, as our listeners have probably gathered by now, we are on purpose not revealing how all of this ends at your request. So people need to read the book in order to hear how your quest to finally meet and interview and maybe even toss a football around with Tom Brady, how that quest ultimately ends. The book is also, to a large extent, about you becoming enamored with the game of football again after some years away. And you said that maybe it had something to do with turning 40 and becoming a father. Perhaps it's psychological, perhaps it's chemical. Have you yet figured out the answer to that question of why you found yourself drawn back to football so forcefully?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we try to identify what is our most masculine sport, you know, in the U.S., I think most people would agree that it's football in terms of at least the major ones. And, yeah, I think there was a certain element of me of, you know, kind of walking around with my daughter, who is amazing, you know, in the baby Bjorn, and, you know, just sort of feeling I wasn't quite, you know, the man that, you know, and I'm a literature professor. I, you know, what do I do at the end of a day? I send a lot of emails, I grade papers, I read books. You know, I would like to be working more with my hands and accomplishing more at the end of a day. And so it was a lot of thinking about, like, about masculinity in general. And here is, you know, Brady in so many ways is such like the alpha gorilla, you know. I mean, he is, you know, accomplished so much in one of the most masculine environments out there.
Well, the book is just terrific. Again, it's called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback, published by 4Edge, and the author, Richard J. King. Richard King, congrats on a great book, and thank you for making time for this interview. It was fun to talk with you. Best wishes.
Thanks a lot. That was a really nice interview. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, yet another interview played from the archives in memory of Dr. Yuri Maltsev, longtime professor of economics at Carthage. This conversation from 2018 has Professor Maltsev talking about the disaster at Chernobyl. He was living and working in Moscow at the time of that catastrophe, and he offers a rare and fascinating insight on what it was like to live through those dramatic moments. That will be